Presidio had been known to me only as a place on the map that the weatherman said was the hottest in the United States, usually around 103. And this airport had been billed by Liz as one where you had to buzz the runway to get the antelope off before you landed, a virtually abandoned army installation of World War II, now sparsely used by the scattered inhabitants of this arid land. If Liz meant just to excite us, the truth of it was later proved when a departing private airplane, on Monday that is, collided with an antelope, considerable damage and danger. This time, we did see a herd grazing peacefully within yards of the runway, and a crowd assembled around the little speaking stand, some 3,500 strong, a mighty lot of folks in this country, more than half the population of all the towns and ranches for miles around. All the mayors were lined up in a long receiving line for me to greet as we got off the plane. The wind was blowing mightily, and the Sol Ross College Band playing the Yellow Rose of Texas, and all the little children grinning and waving homemade signs, "Welcome, Lady Bird, you doll, and you all." John Ben Shepherd at my elbow escorting me everywhere. And the keynote of the day, the keynote of the country, was set for me when the presiding mayor made his little speech and said, "Ordinarily, on an occasion like this, the mayor presents you with the key to the city. But we don't have any key, because we don't have any locks on our door. You're mighty welcome. Freedom, openness, that is the spirit of this part of the country." Instead, they gave us a sombrero, quite nice ones for the you dolls and me, and straw ones for every last one of the 70-odd newspaper entourage. I shook hands with just as many as I could get to, because one lady from Marfa had said, "Nobody ever stops here, all they do is fly over us." There was one hilarious moment when I spotted a 4-year-old boy with a huge yellow button upside down. I turned it right side up and found, to my horror, that it said, "Support sloppiness." So I quickly turned it over again. There was a sheriff's posse in quite authentic cowboy clothes, mounted, ringed around the airport, a backdrop of mountains behind them. Stu and George Herzog and Congressman Dick White, who was with us everywhere, and I lined up, the wind whipping us in the face, to have our picture made. And then we were off, headed toward Pancho Villa country, the 2-hour drive to the Big Bend. Sometimes we crossed the famous old Comanche Indian Trail. The scenery was an ever-changing panorama of mountains and volcanic mesas and swirls of tumbleweed, a few struggling bluebonnets and cactus and yucca, and finally great expanses of nothing at all except creosote bushes with little tiny yellow blossoms on it. It's said that they smell bad, and they're hated by the ranchers because once started, they take everything over. No grass, nothing grows around them. It was a harsh, forbidding land, hostile to man, a land of arroyos and mountains barricaded by boulders and armored with plants that either stick, a sting, a stink, somebody had written. I kept on looking at it with the eyes of the homesteader who had come through in a wagon about 1910 with his pregnant wife and 3-year-old child, a small load of supplies, and one Mexican guide on a burro, looking for some health-giving mineral springs he'd heard about. And for days and days he'd crossed just such country, but he had described, along the way, sweeping fields of grass, and once a forest of blooming century plants, a 4-foot stalks of ivory-colored flowers, a breathtaking spectacle. And I remember that during and after the First World War, somewhere I'd read, the land was heavily overstocked, cattle and sheep and goats had simply eaten off every blade of grass, and later, rather cynically, this was how it actually came to be a national park at all, because it was so poor, so low in value, that a few public-spirited citizens, among them Amon Carter, had begged and badgered for money and for federal government aid to save this wild stretch of wilderness, the park. Can it be that mankind can do this to a big piece of the earth in just half a century? Or did the old homesteader remember right? It had been a charming book, the memoirs of a man who'd actually done it, helped out in writing by Fred Gibson, a very competent Texas writer. Here and there on the lonely landscape, you could see a few cottonwood trees and a windmill. That spelled mankind, life. Somebody had had nerve enough, to dig a well and build a house and try to eke out a living. The cottonwood tree is a very symbol out here to me. It says, here man is. Very rarely on this two-hour trip along a really great highway, we came to some settlement, once the filling station, once the little community. In each case, I am sure every living human being was out by the side of the road, waving, grinning, carrying a sign. One sign was so funny I had to stop and say, let's get our picture taken. Six young girls, all Latinos, had encased themselves in cardboard boxes, a hole at the top through which their heads stuck, a hole at the bottom for their feet, and on each box a big letter so that lined up they read, MRSLBJ. And they were all jumping up and down hollering, welcome, welcome. For once, I can say I was the biggest thing that happened in a town. It looked like every business establishment had a sign, and every person had a smile and a big wave. A little after noon, the terrain began to rise, and about 12:30, just as the mountains were beginning, we stopped at Panther Junction at the headquarters of the Big Bend National Park. They have an indoctrination center, a stone building that nestles very much at home on the landscape, and in it exhibits that tell the story of its geology, its history, its plant and animal life. What a good graphic beginning for a family vacation to stop here and learn about what they're going to see. It's one of the many reasons I like the National Park Service. This was our first encounter with the Odessa Chuckwagon Gang. Not first for me, because I'd met them at a political rally long ago. In, I believe, a high school gymnasium in Odessa, and they'd given Lyndon one of that yellow shirts. But here they were, some 25 or so strong, serving us barbecue and frijoles and slaw and iced tea, and I was never hungrier. I have a fault to find with so-called banquets where one is the honor guest. You don't get to eat. Just as I started to take a bite, George Hartzog motioned to me to stand up, please. There was a little ceremony. And this was the time, of course, when I handed him the check, I'd already made it out, for $7 to the pass that entitled me to go to all of the national parks that I wanted to all the time in the year 1966. I have no fault to find with this. I couldn't spend $7 better. But back to the table, and one good bite, and then there was a presentation of a painting. It was a landscape of the Big Bend country, done by a local artist, and given to me by a much-loved local woman who'd played a large part in bringing the park into being. I was delighted to have it, but still hungry. I got back to the table, and other guests kept on coming up, being introduced. Ever so many of them were good friends. The Bill Knowles, Mamie Shepherd. Meanwhile, there was mariachi music. A tall, handsome Mexican in an enormous, heavily embroidered hat with a serape over his shoulder was singing the plaintive songs of Mexico, Guadalajara, Tierra del Sol, La Paloma, and of course the Rancho Grande. And then the time came for me to stand up and have my picture made with him wearing his hat and his serape draped over my shoulder. Back at the table, I hungrily wolfed large mouthfuls of the beans, barbecue, and drafts of the iced tea, making believe there were no cameras clicking away, or maybe simply weighing in the fact that the pictures would be awful and deciding that one more bite was worth it. But alas, every time I arose for some little ceremony, the unceasing West Texas wind would blow away my napkin. I deposited a little more sand in my plate. One lady's plate simply rose up and swept away from in front of her. And then it was time to stand up and have my picture made with Stew and all the assembled group of the Odessa Chuckwagon Gang and tell them how wonderful the barbecue had been. And back in the cars we were, and off up to the Chisos Mountains to the Park Basin, which was our destination. Here the land began to rise more sharply. We were leaving the endless, hostile desert country and going up into the Chisos Mountains themselves. That is a word for ghosts. Why, I do not know. Could it be because they are so lonely? And to the vegetation was added the juniper tree, so well known to me, bane of the rancher's life. But two other kinds of juniper I had never seen before. The weeping juniper, whose branches droop as though they were about to draw their last breath of life. And the alligator juniper, with a very rough, scaly bark. And the madrona tree, though not as plentiful as I had seen it on the Cato's ranch. a little after 2:30, we arrived at the Park Basin headquarters. Quite rustic facilities, completely suited to the terrain. I had a small but pleasant cabin, and thought what a nice place this would be with about three other people that you love dearly, to walk and walk and ride, and maybe play bridge at night. We had time to change into our clothes, blue jeans and red check shirt, and my sombrero. And then all of us, you dolls, park naturalists, Secret Service men, and some 70 or so newspaper folks, gathered at the beginning of Lost Mine Trail for a two-hour hike. Here is where it became quite hilariously evident to me that we were, in a way, the victims of our own success. We had two diametrically opposed, incompatible elements. Surrounded by this wilderness, these majestic, towering crags, this eons-old graphic story of the geologic history of the earth, this solitude, into it came thundering our motley crew of 100 or so. As Isabel Shelton put it, at Big Bend you couldn't see the wilderness for the people. There soon stood out one character, a newspaper woman in bright red breeches, carrying a bright red umbrella. As she climbed the mountain, we all remember her, and I expect she got more words in print and more pictures than anybody on the trip, with the possible exception of me. Stuart and I set the pace, and a naturalist came right along beside us to tell us about the wildlife. Actually, we saw little, but how could we? We'd probably frighten them all away. None of the panthers or rattlesnakes that Liz had promised us. He told us they were there, but rare. The bird life was enormously abundant. One, the Kalima warbler, found only in this area. And most interestingly to me, he described the relic forests of maple and ponderosa pine with huge trunks. Some strange mystery of nature, they were left over from a much earlier time when the climate was different here. On the other side of the mountain, they were reachable by horseback. The naturalist, Perry Brown, I believe it was, told us that when the weather was very dry and there was a fire, they were always scared, because if the fire got to these trees and they went, there would be no more. They are not reseeding themselves. They are simply a freak of nature, left over from another time, hundreds of miles from any others of their kind. The prettiest trees were the piñon pines, like my Christmas tree. On the way up at the marvelous vistas, Stuart and I raced to see who could first use the line, "On a clear day you can see forever." And you can. In one direction you see into Mexico. It's a wild, free land, and it does something to you. Liz called it Marlboro Country. I think Roll Your Own Country is better. I shall remember it hauntingly. But it is not for the luxury lover. As for Lost Mine itself, it was a quicksilver mine. If it ever existed, perhaps it is a legend, though there is quicksilver in the country nearby. At the top of the trail, we all stopped. The newspaper folks got out their microphones or tapes or tablets, and I gave a brief word picture of the way I felt about the day. What an amazing crew we were. Life magazine was represented, and Time, and Newsweek, and Better Homes and Gardens, and Venture Magazine, and of course National Geographic. There was Betty Beale, veteran of Washington Drawing Room, who actually seemed to love it, and Nancy Dickerson, who always managed to look like she just stepped out of Vogue. And I assure you the conditions were adverse. NBC, CBS, and ABC were all there. And of course the wire services, with Helen Thomas and Francis Lewin. Texas newspapers heavily represented by Fort Worth Star-Telegram, Big Bend Sentinel, San Angelo Standard Times, Houston Chronicle, Dallas News, El Paso Times, Andrews County News. KTBC was there with Cactus. Nobody had a better time than Wahilla LaHaye of Scripps Howard. And I'll never forget Fred Maroon going backwards up a steep, winding mountain trail, carrying his heavy, wonderful camera equipment. Amazingly, Mademoiselle was represented, though it was certainly no fashion show. A sizable range of local radio stations, Odessa, Midland, Fort Worth. One was delightfully labeled Pony Express. I'm sure this is Liz's humor, and meant that he simply, somehow or another, got the dispatches out from this remote fastness of the world, down to a place where there's more than one telephone. Then we walked down the mountain, and had just time for about an hour's rest before the most delightful part of the day began. About 6:30, we all gathered on a little mesa top, gay with red checkered tablecloths, and a campfire glowing brightly in the middle of it. To the west was the most spectacular view, the window, a cleft between two mountains. Through it, you could really see forever to another mountain range far in the distance. And to the east, right behind us, rose a gigantic sheer mountain called the Castle. Everybody was in a merry mood. There was the water hole. The water was a purely secondary ingredient. And then a delicious, ample meal and plenty of time to eat it. Everybody was gay. High spirits were contagious. And we all swapped tales about our experiences of the day. To me, one of the happiest things was seeing a roommate, Kay Sullivan, she'd been then, Mrs. Walter Grigsby now, of Sanderson, Texas. We lived together in 1930-31 at the university. And I had not seen her in at least 25 years. It's mighty hard to go through Sanderson no matter where you travel. Even here, she was 200 miles from me. But when we'd called her, she'd said yes indeed, she and her husband would love to drive up for the barbecue. She's been a school teacher ever since, raised a daughter, lived a useful if rather narrow life, and is one of the sweetest people I know. We had so much fun saying, "You remember when?" All this time, the most magnificent drama was happening in the sky above us. Sundown and twilight, and the unceasing play of lights and shadows and the nuances of colors in the sky and on the sides of the mountains. Sometimes I think the Lord made up in this western big sky country for what he didn't give us in rainfall, in verdant vegetation, with the glory of the sky. It was the most superb theater. Fit subject for a symphony or a poem, but for me, just an hour of delight that was almost tangible, of a heightened feeling of being alive. And then the final magnificent touch. Out above the castle, a full moon rose. It hadn't been in the plans, not even Liz's plans. And as it rose, the campfire grew brighter. A ranger threw on chunks every now and then. It was down in a hole with big boulders around it, built very properly. And Navajo rugs began to be flung out on the ground around the campfire. And then there was another hour of magic. First, a young group of college boys from Cyril Ross, called the Believers, sang folk songs. Fresh, wholesome-faced young country boys who I'd lay a bet had never joined a protest march, but who would be quick, if needed, to join the armed services. And then Joe France, head of the Department of History at the University of Texas, in a rather quiet, sing-song sort of a voice, began to weave together a fabric of the place and the time we were in. Why the West, this part of the West, was what it was, its history, the tribal plains Indians, the Spanish conquistadores, the westward thrust of the Anglos, wild tales of Pancho Villa, of its economy, the determined homesteader, the cattleman, the Mexicans making Candelaria wax, the whole philosophy and feel of the West. It was a mood piece, very subtly and delightfully done, all of a part with the evening. Cactus Pryor, naturally, was the MC, and he himself, in a long beard, came hobbling in out of the dark with his own tall tales of Texas. And then he introduced Brownie McNeil, the president of Cyril Ross College, with the observation that, "You see, nearly all our entertainment tonight is PhDs. Brownie had a guitar and sang frontier songs that ranged from the old English ballads originating in the Appalachians to right off the range ones like Little Joe the Wrangler. Meanwhile, the full moon rode higher and higher above the castle. The campfire died softly, and everybody settled comfortably on his Navajo blanket and fell under the spell of the music. What a night to remember. It was sheer enchantment. But by 10 o'clock, dead tired, I was glad to say goodnight and go to my cabin, full to the brim of the pleasant satisfactions of the day. A high, racy day, worth 5 ordinary days of living.